Is Big Pharma fueling the ADHD epidemic?
You're getting so many people getting misdiagnosed that that's really what the book is about. It's about how we've taken something that could be a legitimate construct, it can be a real disorder, and the medications can do a lot of good in the appropriate circumstances. But we are using the diagnosis and the medication so often in inappropriate circumstances that I think we need to discuss it as a nation. It's a public health issue.
That's Alan Schwartz. We talk with him about his book, ADHD Nation. Then maybe ADHD isn't so much a disorder as a different type of brain, one with great gifts as well as deficits.
The reason that I think people need to understand ADHD from a different perspective is nobody can give people born with this brain type their brilliance. But people that are born with this brain type can learn to manage their behaviors through understanding their brain and how they operate. So they can use their strengths better to mitigate the weaknesses and limitations that they have and build their strengths to manage things.
That's Carol Genoux. She tells us about her book, Your Innovator Brain, The Truth About ADHD. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. ADHD is an epidemic. Nationwide, 15% of kids are diagnosed with a disorder, and in some regions of the country, it runs as high as 30%. But is the disorder an epidemic, or its diagnosis? And what's fueling it? In his new book, ADHD Nation, New York Times journalist Alan Schwartz says the pharmaceutical industry's relentless drive for profits is putting millions of kids at risk by pushing the ADHD diagnosis onto an anxious public. It's the ADHD industrial complex, Schwartz says, an unholy alliance between big pharma, researchers, and government agencies promoting powerful drugs that have the potential for abuse. Like the ads that claim your kid will get all A's and take out the garbage to boot if you just give him or her a pill like Adderall. But what if your kid's problems aren't due to ADHD, but to anxiety or maybe just too much teaching to high-stakes tests? And what about those kids who take the drugs to get ahead and end up getting addicted instead? Alan Schwartz is a Pulitzer Prize-nominated national correspondent at the New York Times. He's best known for his groundbreaking coverage of the seriousness of concussions among football players. His book is published by Simon & Schuster. Alan Schwartz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is really a terrific book, ADHD Nation, Children, Doctors, Big Pharma and the Making of an American Epidemic. You go into not only the current situation with ADHD, but in the history. But before we kind of get into that, tell us, first of all, what is your sense of how prevalent this diagnosis actually is?
Well, and I appreciate your saying prevalence of the diagnosis, because there's a big difference, prevalence of the disorder and prevalence of the diagnosis of the disorder. And the American Psychiatric Association makes it very clear in the official definition and diagnostic manual for ADHD, says that it affects about 5% of children. Okay, so let's just go with that. Well, right now, according to the CDC, we're diagnosing about 15% of children, which is so much far beyond that 5%, it's ridiculous. And so while, you know, hopefully the 5% who really do fit the construct are getting diagnosed, you're getting so many people beyond that getting misdiagnosed that that's really what the book is about. It's about how we've taken something that could be a legitimate construct. It has helped a lot of people. You know, people, it can be a real disorder, and the medications can do a lot of good in the appropriate circumstances. But we are using the diagnosis and the medications so often in inappropriate circumstances that I think we need to discuss it as a nation. It's a public health issue. So here we are.
Yes, and that's really what's so valuable about this book is making those distinctions. You talk about what is a valid disorder. How would you want it to be diagnosed?
Well, the question of whether ADHD is a valid disorder or not, these are words that have different meanings to different people. And the way I start is simply to say, look, American Psychiatric Association, you have defined it. We'll use your definition. We'll use your prevalence estimate. You've asked us to consider you the experts. You make the rules. Fine. And it is supposed to be present in two different settings, talking about a child. It should be in both the home and in school. You should be talking to, you know, lots of teachers. The appropriate diagnosis, you know, in terms of taking a full history of the child and making sure you understand where could these behaviors of hyperactivity, impulsivity, lack of attention span, where could those things be coming from? Because they could be coming from things other than ADHD. Sometimes it is ADHD, or at least it certainly appears to be, and that's fine. But you cannot make an appropriate diagnosis in 20 or 30 minutes. Now, unfortunately, that's happening a lot, but it doesn't really matter what Schwartz thinks is an appropriate diagnosis. And so all I'm trying to do is hold them to what they say is the appropriate thing to do. And right now, there are way too many times when we are just reflexively calling a kid ADHD and prescribing medication before doing the appropriate work to see if that's really the kid's problem.
You know, there are a lot in the field, and you speak about those who are in the field, folks like Dr. Ed Hallowell, who we've actually interviewed on this show many years ago, and others who say that it's actually underdiagnosed. They'll admit that sometimes it's overdiagnosed, but they also say that it's underdiagnosed. What's your take on that?
Well, I think, by the way, just for whatever it's worth, Ned has kind of changed his tune a little bit from over the years, and he now recognizes, I think, what I've been trying to get people to see. The words over and underdiagnosed, to me, are misused a lot. I mean, overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed, those refer to populations. They're epidemiological terms, really. And right now, if 15% of kids are getting diagnosed, and the official definition of ADHD suggests that it should be around 5, you know, the issue of overdiagnosis, that's not rhetoric. That's arithmetic. I mean, 15 is a heck of a lot higher than 5. And so anybody who argues that ADHD is underdiagnosed, often what they mean is that there are kids out there who qualify for the disorder and need the help associated with the diagnosis and with, oftentimes, the medication. There are a non-zero number of kids out there who really do qualify and would benefit from it. However, we are so going beyond what is an appropriate diagnostic rate that anybody who says that ADHD is underdiagnosed is a fool.
And
now, I don't use the term overdiagnosis. Okay, I'm merely using it right now because I'm parroting what other people have said. I don't use that term. I use the term misdiagnosis because overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis talk about populations. I talk about specific kids. We have a kid sitting in front of us. Does he or does he not fit the ADHD construct? We either get that diagnosis correct or we get it incorrect. The goal is to get every diagnosis correct or maximize the number of correct diagnoses. Right now, the number of kids who really have ADHD who are not diagnosed are outnumbered tenfold by the number of kids who don't have ADHD, who have been diagnosed. You know, ADHD is both overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed. And that means that the ones who are diagnosed are the wrong ones.
Right.
And it's time that we recognize where this rhetoric has led us.
Right. You know, one of the red flags, I think, that you point out in your book, Alan Schwartz, that you point out in ADHD Nation, is that the rates of diagnosis of ADHD vary depending on the region of the country. In fact, widely, I mean, you've cited this 15% diagnosis rate, but also in some places it's as high as 30%. So what's going on there?
Well, first of all, the 15%, as you said, that's for the entire nation. 15% of kids get diagnosed with ADHD, about 20% of boys, almost 20% of boys, and 11% of all girls across the entire nation. Now, there are regions, as you said, where the diagnostic rates are considerably higher. And in many southern states, that 30% figure refers to the number of boys. And there are lots of different theories for why this may be the case. You have issues with respect to economic status. A lot of it can be related to the lack of good psychiatric or mental health services for children. You know, there are places in sort of the rural heartland, if you will, where, you know, you have to drive 50, 60 miles for somebody who's really a child psychiatrist. Or has expertise, you know, any, you know, vague expertise in this area. And so you're left with people, you know, general practitioners, you know, whether it's pediatricians or other people who don't really know, many of whom, not all by any means, but many of whom do not have any training in this area and frankly don't really necessarily know what they're doing. You see them making the diagnosis and not knowing how extensive and how complicated the diagnostic process truly is. So you see a wide range, of, you know, almost preposterously, but nonetheless wide range of diagnosis rates across the country.
So let's talk a little bit about how this situation developed. What is driving the misdiagnosis of ADHD? Give us kind of a summary of the history of this diagnosis, how it took us from there to here.
Well, there have always been hyperactive kids, a lot of boys. There have always been kids who just can't seem to pay attention and to follow through on things. And as medicine grew up and as psychiatry grew up, there was a consideration of whether this was a psychiatric type issue. And this grew from the 50s and the 60s. This syndrome was more called minimal brain dysfunction. It became attention deficit disorder in 1980. And you saw an effort, an increasing effort, to identify kids who were so severely impaired in these areas that they needed help. I mean, this derives from a great amount of care on the part of parents and doctors for the fate and well-being of children. And you can see that historically. And so the interventions could be, you know, the diagnosis and then oftentimes the medication, you know, historically Ritalin, but now Adderall, Concerta, Vyvanse, things like that. You would see 1, 2, maybe 3% of kids and a considerable majority of those boys getting diagnosed and usually receiving medication because their problems were so severe. Well, as we got, you know, further and further and further into the 80s and the 90s, you know, more parents were like, well, my kid looks ADHD too. And this medication has done wonders for Billy next door. Maybe it'll do wonders for my kid. One of the things to know is that the medications, they do a heck of a job in these areas for a lot of kids. They get them to slow down and pay more attention and be more controlled. And, you know, that's something that a lot of parents and teachers value. So you just see this diagnosis creep where more and more kids are getting brought to the doctor in order to be evaluated for the condition. Now, one of the problems is that more and more of these kids are being treated by people who don't have any training in this area. Specifically, pediatricians have very little training. You also have the marketing of the syndrome and of the medications, mostly done by pharmaceutical companies, Shire, Eli Lilly, firms like that, where they have propagated an image of ADHD both directly and indirectly, was like, well, hey, if your kid's struggling a little bit to pay attention, and he literally, one of the ads said, you know, if he's not taking out the garbage, he might have ADHD, so you should bring him to the doctor and try Adderall. I mean, it was preposterous. The complete misrepresentation of what the syndrome was and what the medications were appropriate for. And so you just have a lot of these forces. Another one is the competition for college, good high schools and good colleges. You know, parents think that, you know what, I want my kid to have every possible advantage. And if you get a diagnosis of ADHD, not only do you get these pills that in general will help a child concentrate and study harder, but also sometimes you will get accommodations like more time for tests. None of these is solely or even in a majority sense responsible for the explosion of diagnoses well beyond the appropriate rate. They all just sort of contribute that little bit. But I think the good thing is that it also gives us a lot of areas for potential reform. There are all sorts of ways to help temper the, you know, the zeal for diagnosing so many kids with what is generally considered a lifetime, you know, possibly life-impairing brain disorder. Frankly, if you're going to tell a kid there's something wrong with your brain, you better darn well be right.
Well, one of the things that makes your book so powerful is to show how, I think you call this the medical industrial complex. I mean, we could call it a medical corporate complex or Big Pharma, which is right in the title of your book, Children Doctors, Big Pharma, and the Making of an American Epidemic, is how the relentless drive for profits has really driven this epidemic of misdiagnosis. So talk about how the companies have kind of driven the market, through their marketing, have driven this epidemic.
Well, I think it's a combination, honestly, of both the drug companies and the doctors, okay, mm-hmm. and the researchers who sometimes are directly influenced by pharma, but also indirectly or are on their own, have gotten way too enthusiastic about using the ADHD diagnosis to build their practices and, you know, afford their vacations and summer homes. The pharmaceutical companies, first of all, they have co-opted the research that is conducted in, you know, specifically in ADHD, lots of other psychiatric issues, where they are the ones who fund the university researchers, the university doctors to perform studies on the medications, on the syndrome. The idea being is they're paying them to make them look good and to make the syndrome look so bad and look so devastating that they can create these ads that say, if you don't give your kid, you know, you don't get him diagnosed and medicated, he's going to die in a car crash, or he's going to have no friends, or he's going to become a drug addict. But guess what? There's this medication that this Harvard University group has shown to reduce the risk for all these terrible things. And all they've done is they've really paid all these researchers hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars to come up with this stuff. Now, all of it can be based in pieces of truth. That's part of the problem. ADHD is very serious. And if you have raging ADHD, really bad attention span and impulsivity is not the best thing to have when you're behind the wheel. So when we know that, but it's been such a distortion and contortion of what the syndrome is and what the medications are truly for. You know, ads for parents started coming out. They did direct-to-consumer advertising starting about 15 years ago, where they would literally say that if you give, you know, a child Adderall, hey, you know, he could take out the garbage more, or he'll get grades that match his intelligence, which is complete hogwash. I mean, ADHD kids can be as intelligent as anybody else, but you don't all of a sudden, you know, oh, now he's going to do great because he has this pill. And so, look, I'm not a nonprofit myself. Presumably you aren't either. I mean, we're all trying to make a living. But in this case, the doctors and researchers who were making millions off of the continued rise and acceptance of ADHD, of the ever higher diagnosis rates. And then the pharmaceutical companies, who of course sold ever more drugs to the point where I think it's over $10 billion a year now, you know, they have all forgotten that we're talking about children's brains. They should know better, and they should realize, hey, wait a minute, there's really a limit to this. They just don't seem willing to admit the problem that they've caused.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Alan Schwartz about his book, ADHD Nation, Children, Doctors, Big Pharma, and the Making of an American Epidemic.
One of those problems is addiction, but I'm going to hold off on that for just a second because you mentioned the researchers. And there's a very famous study that you talk about in the book from the National Institutes of Mental Health, NIMH, a study where the group spent 14 months studying the impact of medication alone, medication with cognitive behavioral therapy, and then I believe therapy alone. Talk a little bit about that study, the results, and how it really illustrates this problem that you're talking about.
Well, in the early 1990s, Ritalin had gone through a very interesting recent history. The use of it had grown and grown through the 70s and 1980s to the point where there was actually some considerable backlash. At the end of the 1980s, there were a lot of lawsuits from parents saying that my kid was pushed by the school into taking Ritalin when he really shouldn't have, doctors misdiagnosing it. Now, a lot of those lawsuits were funded by the Church of Scientology, which has their own agenda toward psychiatry. These lawsuits were very high profile. They were on all the talk shows, you know, Phil Donahue, Oprah, you know, all that stuff. It was very big news. And the rates of diagnosis and use of medication actually plunged 1989, 1990, 1991. But then they started going up again a lot. And so the nation was sort of confused about, wait a minute, you know, what is ADHD and does Ritalin actually benefit kids? This is an important thing. And so the National Institutes of Mental Health said, let's just get all the best doctors out there to come in and conduct the ultimate study. And let's really put Ritalin with cognitive behavioral therapy in a horse race. Cognitive behavioral therapy is non-medication. It is teaching the parents more than the kids, frankly, about creating a more conducive environment at home, helping the kid concentrate better, helping the kid be less hyperactive and impulsive through other means, teaching them better skills, things like that. And, of course, it's like, well, which one's better? Well, they decided to try to find out, and they designed what they considered the ultimate study to finally answer this great societal question. And they had, you know, one quarter of the kids get medication only. They had one quarter of the kids get behavioral therapy only. They had one quarter of the kids get both. And then they had one quarter of the kids basically be sort of a control group. And at the end of the study, which, by the way, was supposed to last 4 or 5 years, because cognitive behavioral therapy needs a long time to take hold, whereas Ritalin literally works overnight. Well, at the end of only 14 months, because they ran out of money, they came out with the results. And the results were really, really complicated and had all sorts of nuances. But the thing is what they put out, and what, of course, took hold with the news media, was the final scorecard. And the Ritalin alone, 56% of kids found themselves, you know, significant improvement, and then 34% of behavioral therapy alone had significant improvement. And so all the headlines were, you know, Ritalin beats therapy for ADHD, doctors say Ritalin works, all this, these complete misrepresentations of what the study actually said. Because if you looked at the study, frankly, it showed that even the best use of Ritalin only helped the kids roughly half the time. No one seemed to notice that. And all sorts of just vast other problems. And so they had this, what was considered the ultimate, final, last word on, you know, the use of Ritalin in children, and they totally botched it. And it's been used ever since to sell medication. And that's a shame. It doesn't mean medication's bad. All it means is that the conduct of science in order to answer these questions has been so lacking, and yet our reliance on the results has been so blind that you don't really know what works and what things are anymore. Mm-hmm. And it seems like nobody's really been paying attention to looking back, as you've acknowledged, this whole history of how we got here and saying, you know what, we need to do better for our kids. That doesn't mean throwing out the ADHD construct. That's here to stay. But what you need to do is just slow down and try to get the right kids diagnosed and helping the other kids who have real problems. They need help, but they really don't fit the ADHD construct. And so maybe giving them Adderall and Concerta is not the way to go, because then you're not treating their real problems. I don't see why that should be so controversial.
Right. And even for those kids who may benefit from medication or who do have ADHD, I think you do point out in the book that some combination of medication and therapy was the most effective treatment.
It was. But again, I don't want to put too much credence in any of the results. You know, the whole thing was a mess. It was an entire disaster.
And driven very much by, you know, the needs of the industry to base, and as you point out, the media for an easy solution here. But of course, with medication, there are some very serious drawbacks. This medication is basically amphetamines or an amphetamine based.
You know, but I think that, you know, we have to be careful. You know, I mean, oxycodone, which, you know, is a very good medication for a lot of people. You know, that's an opioid. You know, it's sort of the words that you use can imply inherent misuse or inherent dangers.
No, I'm not doing that. But what I am saying is that there is a huge potential for abuse. And in fact, you tell some stories in the book. I think we only have time for Jameson Monroe, although there are two kids you really talk about, a girl who also ran into problems, Kristen Barber. But this student, Jameson Monroe, who did not have ADHD, is one of the kids who, you know, was really driven to try to bring up his grades, fell into a terrible cycle of addiction. Talk a little bit about him and maybe just ending on what he and Kristen Barber ultimately began working together to try to deal with the problem.
Well, these drugs are known to help anybody, not just ADHD kids, okay? But anybody will be a candidate to have these drugs improve their concentration, improve their sort of stick-to-itiveness, their ability to stay up later and work harder. And a lot of people don't realize that. Sometimes the doctors and pharmaceutical companies say, well, you know, if you don't have ADHD, it doesn't do anything for you, which is just incredibly irresponsible. And so particularly when you use the drugs, you know, not at the proper dose and not in the proper at the proper times, you start using them in order to work harder, whether you're a high school student, a college student, or for that matter, a stockbroker or a lawyer, you start messing really with the addictive properties of what, as you said, are amphetamines. And generally, a lot of people really like the buzz that they get. And some people have addictive natures. Some people have whatever the gene is for substance abuse disorders. And you don't really know until after you've gotten into a lot of trouble. And as you said, one of the main characters of the book, because my book is not a screed, it's a story. It's a story of several people who exemplify the problems. And this kid, Jameson Monroe, is one of those kids who in high school was feeling so much academic pressure, so much pressure to be what everyone around him needed him to be and to get into Harvard, that he started taking Adderall to stay up later and study harder. And unfortunately, he was one of the kids who fell into terrible addiction and other substance abuse relating to his abuse of Adderall. The other girl, she's very different, but nonetheless had some similar problems later in life. And they have sort of teamed up now as young adults to help other kids get through what they experienced themselves.
So finally, after having done this book, what do you feel is the most important lesson for people to take away from it?
I think what they need to realize is I am not saying that ADHD is fake, or I'm not saying that medication is evil and it shouldn't be ever used. All I am asking is that we slow down and make sure that the kids who really fit the construct and who for whom the medication is designed get diagnosed and helped for what appears to really be their problem. And we call that problem ADHD. And then the kids who may have other problems but don't have ADHD don't get diagnosed and medicated for something they do not have, and often to their detriment. We need to do a much better job of identifying the right kids. And all we have to do is have the parents slow down, the doctors slow down, the teachers slow down, and realize, hey, let's just be more careful.
And what about adults? Because now adults are being diagnosed more and more with ADHD. Do you think the same problem exists with
Well, it's a different type of problem, okay? I think there's a big difference between children and adults, largely because children do not have informed consent, okay, with regard to what they're diagnosed with and what medications they take. Now, I'm not saying you can't make a diagnosis and use medication in a kid. We all decide our kids are going to have certain medical treatments that, you know, frankly, it's nobody else's business but ours. However, you don't have that issue with adults. If an adult wants to go to a doctor and be diagnosed with a psychiatric condition and take medication for it, you know, that's frankly their business. But then you also have the issue of adults being able to take themselves to the doctor and just sort of fake ADHD and get amphetamine for what is essentially free. And so you have different pitfalls. And what we're seeing now with adults is you're seeing the same marketing that completely distorted the world of child ADHD. You're starting to see it used in adults. And because adults can act on their own volition, you have a different set of challenges, but you're going to have the same issues with overdiagnosis. But again, I tend to focus on kids because they are somewhat more helpless in all of this.
Right, and also the impact of these medications is more uncertain. Well, Alan Schwartz, it's really a terrific book. I highly recommend it to all our listeners, ADHD Nation, Children, Doctors, Big Pharma, and the Making of an American Epidemic. Thanks so much for talking with us about this important subject.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Alan Schwartz is a national correspondent for the New York Times. In addition to ADHD Nation, he's the author of two books about baseball. Hear an audio excerpt from ADHD Nation by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, it's not ADHD, it's the innovator brain. Stay tuned after the break.
Your ADHD will set you free. Or concentration equals evolution. A boring stagnation is a situation that is unavoidable.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As someone who both has ADHD and is a parent of someone who has it, I know the condition is real, but I also know that it brings great gifts along with its deficits, like creativity, insatiable curiosity, and a kind of big-picture thinking that comes up with creative solutions to problems. These are the pluses that compensate for the minuses of disorganization, distractibility, and forgetting appointments. So I was intrigued by the title of Carol Janu's book, Your Innovator Brain, The Truth About ADHD. Here, finally, was a book that celebrated the strengths of my kind of brain while acknowledging its weaknesses and giving suggestions about how to compensate for them. Carol Janoux knows whereof she speaks. She has an innovator brain in her parlance and has been coaching people with ADHD for 40 years. Well, Carol Janoux, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, this book, Innovator Brain, The Truth About ADHD, this has a whole very different perspective on the phenomenon of ADHD. ADHD, right up in the name, it's called, you know, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. You have a different take.
I do. I have worked with people with this brain type, starting with children, young children, where I first set up a program to work with children with ADHD. And for the last almost 40 years in various clinics and public school settings and businesses, I've done a lot of research, but basically I've learned from my clients that they're not really disordered and distracted to a fault. Their brains are amazing at coming up with world-class solutions. We certainly wouldn't want to have Steve Jobs be withering on the vine, or have withered on the vine and not given us his amazing things. But of late, and I say of late because I think the psychiatric profession has recently, in the last, I would say, 30, 40 years or so, stigmatized this brain type to a degree that is really unfair. And I work with the people that have suffered from that to try to help them realize that they're different, they're not dysfunctional, and that if society doesn't understand them, because they can certainly come across as annoying and uncommunicative, etc., but if society doesn't understand them, then we just need to do something about that. So my book is an effort to try to help people understand the value of these wonderful people who are more like innovators than anything else.
I wonder if you could approach this from a balanced point of view. I mean, I'm sure there are people listening to this who are saying, wait a second, I know that I've got difficulties. So it's not just all good.
Absolutely. It's not all good. But my take on it has been that we do things very differently. It can look like we are disordered and distracted and impulsive and disorganized. I understand that in a linear world, that's how we appear, but it's just those attributes, or those behaviors, rather, that come across as attributes when you're trying to do some real important work in the world. The reason that I think people need to read my book and need to understand ADHD from a different perspective is nobody can give people born with this brain type their brilliance. But people that are born with this brain type can learn to manage their behaviors through understanding their brain and how they operate, so they can use their strengths better to mitigate the weaknesses and limitations that they have, and build their strengths to manage things, make sure other people that are good at filling in blanks do the filling in blanks while they rock the ideas and get things moving in the corporation or the school or the organization. So we just have to give people the tools and strategies to learn to manage their behavior and make use of their gifts that are considerable. But yes, there's a lot of work that goes along with it. And I've done the work with my clients, so I understand that it can take time, a lot of effort, but it's really worth it in the end. But we first have to work with people's self-esteem. We first got to give them a reason to feel hopeful so they get the help. They don't resign themselves to a life of never feeling like they fit in or are competent.
You start this book with the current way that ADHD is diagnosed and defined. Talk a little bit about the, how it's defined as pathology.
Well, I think that what happens is that when we have a definition about being disordered and distracted, what we're doing is we're talking about a brain type. At least this is how people I have found interpret it. we have a brain type that is permanently flawed in the person's ability to use their executive function part of the brain, the ability to start, follow through, finish projects, communicate, ask questions at the right time, all those really important functions that get us through our workday and get us to finish our projects. It's important to realize that we can set up a structure in our workplaces, and people with ADHD who are in that workplace can make use of the structure that makes sure that there are ways for them to stay on track and communicate and do their jobs better. I've had Fortune 500 companies I've worked within, I've sat across from supervisors and managers who've told me, hey, we all need this. We can all use this. This is good for all of us. So it's almost like we've got to change the perception out there. That's what I'm concerned about.
And you came to this through your own story, too. Tell us, before we get more into the meat of things, how you were informed by your own life on this, and how did you realize the gifts and the difference that it made in your life?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's kind of funny how it happened with me. But basically, I was like a lot of children who grew up with this brain type. I felt stupid and marginalized, and I wanted to hide out because I was afraid I was going to blurt out something dumb, or I was going to be asked to do something and I hadn't listened to the instructions, or I'm going to have to ask somebody to repeat themselves. All those things that make us grow up like we're clueless, because everybody else seems to be able to do what we cannot do. And it's like, it's the kind of stuff we can't do we feel makes us look stupid, and that's why so many of us feel we are. So I kind of went through that, like a lot of people, but there was something always pushing me forward. First of all, we tend to have really good compensating mechanisms, so I could compensate. I didn't understand certain things in school, and that usually is because I was bored with them. I didn't like them, and that's hard for us when we don't like something to pay attention. But I was really, really good at other things. So teachers would scratch their heads and say, we can understand she's like teaches geometry because she's so much better than anybody else in class, but you just can't get her to do anything well in her history class because I was completely bored with history. So I went through that, but I made it through college. I made it through graduate school. But really what happened is I never really understood why I had so much passion for this brain type until my own children, and my son in the eighth grade was diagnosed. And it's funny because I've been working with kids and programs and doing stuff forever, and then all of a sudden he's diagnosed, and I say, oh, my gosh, I have it too. And I still laugh about it because I hadn't really connected the dots.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with ADHD coach and author Carol Genoux about her book, Your Innovator Brain. So you've been talking about brain type. Now let's get down to the details. What are the characteristics of what you call this innovator brain type?
Okay, so just to make sure that everybody understands that the innovator brain is my new label, if you want to call it, or attribution to people with this kind of brain that's commonly called ADHD. It's easy to spot in people because it kind of takes the same trajectory. It occurs the same from person to person. It's got unique expression because each of us is a unique person, and some people have more issues with certain symptoms than others. But basically, it's somebody who is distracted. You know, their brain is listening, but it's not listening for a very long period of time before it's thinking about lunch or something that was forgotten back at home, and then goes back to the conversation but has missed whatever was being talked about. And basically, the best definition that I found for the innovator brain type is an inability to inhibit behavior. People with this brain type tend to live in the moment, so whatever their brain wants to do, they want to follow it. You know, they're like stimulation-seeking brains. So what we have to do is teach people how to manage and control their brain by planning, anticipating, and preparing, which is not something the ADHD brain does. That has to be taught. It's people who know how to do something but just can't do it. It's very difficult time starting, following through, and completing their projects. Need a lot of structure. Real important to have steps, sequencing of steps, deadlines or imperative, chimes, alarms, schedules, all those different things that people can learn to do are actually things that help people get their brain under control. So instead of ADHD or innovator brain, as I call it, managing you, you learn to manage your brain.
I've also heard it said that it's more like difficulty in regulating attention, because I know for myself and for other people I know who have ADHD that when I'm into something, I'm so absorbed by it, I can hyper-focus on it, that everything else goes away.
That's exactly right. And hyper-focusing can work to one's great advantage or certainly to one's disadvantage. I remember in my jobs when I would hyper-focus on getting a project done, I could get so into it, and with the doors closed and there's no noise to distract me, that I would forget meetings. So I'd have to set myself an alarm to make sure that my brain got taken away from that project long enough to evaluate what should I be doing right now in the moment. But see, that's the key to ADHD, or like I say, the innovator brain. The key is that every single ability that we have is useful. Impulsivity, distractibility, disorganization, all those are worth having. But we need to be able to have the others because we're expected to fit in with a linear world. So if we don't have those other organizational and ability to focus and stay focused, we're going to experience problems within our relationships, in our jobs, and personally. So I understand that. But what I teach my clients is that you need to make distinctions. Impulsivity, distractibility, disorganization is good if you're Jonas Salk, who, by the way, the person who found the polio vaccine was ADD. If you're Jonas Salk and you need to find a cure for polio, if you're going A, B, C, D, E, F, G like linear people do, it's going to take you forever. But because of the great intuitive ability of this brain type, if you follow your intuition and you become impulsive, well, let me try this, let me try that. No, wait a minute, hold it. Let me go back here. Well, that's distracting me, but maybe it's valuable. Those are the people that come up with things like Apple computers and scientific and medical advancements.
So what are the differences here? You know, I sometimes think of it, you've mentioned linearity, and I think of global thinking. Like I can leap from one thing to another, possibly because my brain doesn't inhibit things so that the synapses can kind of go across the brain more than people who don't have this type of brain.
You're exactly right. And so there's a real value in that, hence why I call people innovators, because it's the ability to innovate, I think, that sets this brain type apart from all the other ones that we have. You know, we're all part of the human race. We're all Homo sapiens. We all have certain gifts to give and certain ways of doing things. The more we can learn to live together, appreciate, and support each other, the better off the whole world's going to be. We do need innovators more than ever. Look at the world around us. We have a lot of stuff going on that's not so good. So how are we going to deal with it? Well, all these people that have this ability to come up with these solutions and create and invent new ways of doing things are going to make a difference in our world. So we just have to start appreciating them and say, okay, well, how can we set up workplace structures and make sure there's ADHD coaches, or hopefully they'll be called innovator coaches in the future, to work with them and help them teach their brain.
So can you be more specific about the things that make the innovator brain what it is? I mean, we've talked about creativity. What are some of the other aspects of this brain that help it to be innovative?
Because it's a solution-oriented brain, it's always looking for challenges. And when you have a challenge, what are you looking for? You're looking for a solution. You're looking for an answer. You're looking for ideas. So we're natural at that because we're always going there. We want to go there. We get stimulated by it. And we have the ability to think outside the box and use our intuition, which is a big part of it, and come up with ideas that nobody else may have, be able to come up with. That's the way that we're going to come up with new solutions.
I also think that a brain of this kind that is always seeking stimulation is one that is driven by insatiable curiosity.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that, because it's really, really important to realize that that's one of the major assets of this brain type.
So now, some of the ways that you talk about in the book to help somebody who has this innovator brain but also wants to master some of the deficits that come along with it. I was very interested to see some of the things that you suggest that go beyond or instead of even possibly medication, things like exercise, meditation. Talk about those. Why do they help this brain to discipline itself?
You're asking the very best questions. Let's start with exercise. The reason that exercise is so important for people with this brain type, knowing that it's important for all of us, but with this brain type, is because the more oxygen that gets to the brain, the more we have access to disciplining it, to organizing it, to managing it. The oxygenation of the body allows for more of the dopamine to get through to the brain. It allows for us to use what we have to a higher degree. It also allows us to inhibit better. So exercise is one of the primary recommendations. And it doesn't have to be working out at the gym or extraordinary things like running marathons. It can be as simple as climbing up and down stairs. Doesn't have to be hard and difficult. There's any number of ways you can do it. But it's important. And then meditation is the only time that people with this brain type have a chance to slow down and listen to their inner voice, to their inner wisdom, to be able to shed the worries of the day and the conflicts that they're involved in, and be able to center themselves so that they can be at their best as a balanced human being.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with ADHD coach and author Carol Janoux about her book, Your Innovator Brain.
What's really interesting about meditation now, they have at MIT and other places connected people to electroencephalograms and measured brainwave activity between people that never meditate, people that just started meditating, people that have meditated for years and years. And what they're finding is incredible. And one of the findings is how it just increases people's ability to manage themselves and their brain type. And I tell people, look, you don't have to sit in the lotus position for 2 hours and be miserable. A lot of my clients do well with walking meditation. In fact, one of my favorite meditations is find an area nearby that's outdoors, that's the environment. It's got trees and stuff. And walk in there, meditate in there. That is incredible results. So there's a lot of ways to do meditation, like there's a lot of ways to exercise. And surely if you knew that these two things were going to make a huge difference in your ability to have a fulfilling and happy, successful life, you would want to find a way to do them.
Now, you mentioned ADHD coaching or innovator brain coaching. What would a coach do?
So the first thing a coach does is help people to understand their brain. Like, what's going on? Why do things happen the way they do in your life? How can you make sense of the whole thing? So I have people first understand, and then the next step is let's understand how that feels. How is that impacting your life to have had 2 bad performance interviews? Your wife wants to leave you because she says you can't communicate with her, or you don't do what she asks you to do. How is this impacting your life? Because we know that people with this brain type have some very serious issues with just daily living and keeping relationships together and performing at work and being good parents and friends and children. It just breaks my heart to think about all these people that don't have help. So what ADD coaching does, or innovator brain coaching, is help people come to understand their brain, the effect it has on it. And then we start working with the tools that they can use to manage their brain, new strategies, new things that they can try. And the coaching part comes in, especially with me staying with them as they're learning to use them, because we all know behavior change is difficult. People fall off track, and they stay there. And so coaches make sure that people don't quit, because without somebody there to work with you, I can truly say it's impossible to make the changes you need to make. You need somebody to be your advocate and somebody for you to be accountable to make sure you make those changes in what you do. And I feel that people with this brain type can get a lot out of coaching, because I haven't found anything else that works as well. I mean, therapy is great because it can help you heal the past, but coaches also work on healing the past, because you can't work with someone who doesn't go back and say, it wasn't my fault. I wasn't flawed or in some way not good enough and unworthy and marked as a person, that in fact I just never had people to help me understand my brain and how to use it, and that was not my fault. So I always take people in my coaching through the healing journey to go back and then take yourself off the hook of blame, and let's talk about what happened in first grade, second grade, third grade as we go along to make sure they're healing, because otherwise that pain stays within them, and I don't want that.
And if you had to give one tip to spouses or coworkers or bosses about how they should approach somebody who has this innovator or ADHD brain, what would you tell them?
The first thing I would ask the company to do, if, you know, start at the top and work down, if I had that option. If not, I would ask the boss, supervisor, or manager to first learn about what an employee that has an innovator brain is all about. How do they function? What are they good at? What are they not so good at? What do they need? Inform themselves about this type of brain and be sure they understand what they're going to get on a high performance level from that person if they can help them manage the everyday ability to stay focused and get their projects in on time. And then what I would recommend they do is set up like a little survey. It can either be given to them or just it can be spoken to them of questions about what do you need here, how often do you need to check in, what time of day have you learned is best for you to be checking email, when is your best time to set aside 2 hours and really dig in and make progress on your project. Because the people in businesses nowadays many of them haven't had access to any of that help. Mm-hmm. They don't know what coaching can do for them. They don't know what they actually can learn to do to manage their brain. So it's up to the bosses and supervisors to help them with that.
Well, Carol Janou, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about your book, Your Innovator Brain, The Truth About ADHD.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I really, really enjoyed it.
Carol Janou is an ADHD coach. Her website is liveadhdfree.com. Find a link at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.